Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work, enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Makaitis.
Hello, and thanks so much for joining us here for episode 341 with Joe Navarro. I think you'll love this chat with Joe because we're tackling a subject, body language, that is subject to a lot of stuff that you might not fully believe or is just a credible source of information. And Joe is perhaps the most credible source of information on body language. Having done interrogations for dozens of years with the FBI, he knows a thing or two about observing body language and shares some cool stories and very applicable pro tips for how to apply that in work and life. So good. So you'll learn, one, why it's so hard to tell if someone's lying, two, four key reliable body language cues, and three, the one good mannered behavior everyone should know and use. So if you'd like to take a look at the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we've referenced here, it's on over at awesomeatyourjob.com/ep341. And here's Joe's story. For 25 years, Joe Navarro worked as an FBI special agent in the area of counterintelligence and behavioral assessments. Today, he's one of the world's leading experts on nonverbal communications and lectures and consults with major corporations worldwide. He's an adjunct professor at St. Leo University and frequently lectures at the Harvard Business School. So thanks to Agent Joe Navarro for investigating our show, and thanks to our sponsors. Check them out. Here is Joe. Joe, thanks so much for joining us here on the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Pete. It's a long time coming.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm super excited that I've been a fan of your work from afar for a good long time. And so now here we are. But first, I want to hear about how you got a pilot's license when you were 17. Is that even legal or what's the backstory here?
I don't know how you dug that up, but not many people know that. That's true. You know, it was a funny thing. A lot of people make fun of our school systems, public schools in particular, but I was fortunate to go to a public school where the science class that was offered was aeronautics.
No kidding.
No, it was great. It was in Miami, Florida, and you could study ground school, basic ground school, and I took that when I was 16, and then once I turned 17, then I could begin to take flight lessons, and I did. Which you say, well, what do you do with that? Well, interestingly enough, when the FBI came looking for me, that was one of the things that set me apart.
Interesting. So during your time in the FBI, did you do some piloting?
Yeah, you know, in the bureau, you wear a lot of hats, and the first 4 or 5 years, it was pretty much about learning the business of being an FBI agent, working counterintelligence. But along about the fifth or sixth year, there was a real shortage of pilots, and we used aircraft for surveillance, and they knew I had a license, and so I did. I got somewhere around 2,000 hours.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it was pretty nice.
Oh, that is cool. I have very little piloting experience, but I had a buddy who had a little four-seater Cessna in San Francisco. And so I've only piloted for like 5 minutes, but part of it was over the Golden Gate Bridge. And it seems like that'd be hard to top. It was just breathtaking.
Oh, it's just a lot of fun. Once you get up to altitude and you can relax, you're not worried about other aircraft. I mean, it really does give you a different perspective on the world. And I used to take the airplane over to Miami Beach and fly along the coastline. And I, you're 17 years old and you say, this is pretty good. This is bad. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, yeah. So you've written 13 books now, and we're a special agent with the FBI, and are quite an authority on body language. So I want to get into some particulars of body language signals and how to read it, what to do with it. But first, I'd love it if you could set the scene for us with some drama. We had Chris Voss on the show, and I'm just going to go out on a limb and say FBI agents are a great, make great podcast guests. If we're two for two so far. So yeah, I asked him if he could give us a dramatic tale to kick us off. So I'll put you on the same spot. Can you think of a time where boy, a body language signal or insight, you know, just sort of change the whole story for an interrogation or an investigation or something you were working with?
Yeah, one of the books that I wrote was 3 Minutes to Doomsday, and in that book, I talk about this individual who was willing to cooperate or seemed to want to cooperate with the FBI, but he was hiding a lot of information. And so when we asked him to come forward and tell us the truth, because he didn't really have all the access to classified material that we knew had been stolen, he said he wasn't going to reveal their names. So one of the things that we decided to do, since we understood body language, was to basically not trick him into revealing it, but getting him to reveal it at a subconscious level. And what we did was we wrote the names of everybody that could possibly be involved on a 3x5 card. And as we showed him each 3x5 card, we said, "Will you tell us a little bit about what their personality was like?" What he didn't realize was that when you see something that can hurt you, your pupils squint. And his pupils and his eyes squinted on two names of the 32 that we presented. And so then we sent agents out with the Army to two military bases, one in Alaska, one in Georgia. And on the two names that he squinted, both of them confessed.
Oh, wow. That's good.
So what's interesting, Pete, is he wasn't lying. He said, "Look, I'm not going to tell you anything." What he didn't know was how he was going to react.
Yeah.
And we know from studies of babies, 8, 9 months old, when they see somebody they don't like or they see something that is not pleasing to them, oftentimes they will squint, turn away, or their pupils will actually constrict.
Oh, I've got a little 7-month at home. I hope that he doesn't do that to me shortly.
No, that will come.
Daddy, I'm tired of you.
Yeah, Pete, you got 14 years.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, so your latest here is called The Dictionary of Body Language. Sort of, how would you frame or position this one in terms of kind of the main idea, and how does it kind of fit into your opus and the catalog of the other books?
Well, that's a great question, Pete. And it was one of these things where when I wrote What Everybody Is Saying, which became the number one selling body language book in the world years ago, and it's been at the top for the last 8 years. There were only 140 behaviors in there. And 2 years ago, I was talking to my agent, Steve Ross, at Abrams, and he said, "You know, I'm looking at your book." And I said, "Well, I hope you're learning something." And he said, "Is that all there is?" And I said, "No, that's not all there is." And he says, "Well, how many behaviors do you think are important and we should know about?" And I said, "Well, the problem is, you know, how do we write it? There's many behaviors." So I said, "Let me look through my notebook." So I've been keeping notebooks on behavior for years and years and years. And I went through and I said, "Well, I've got about 600 in here, you know." And he said, "Well, you know, let's talk about it." And we talked about it, and then we reduced it down to just over 400 because some of them replicate because they're similar behaviors. And he said, "Have you ever thought about writing a book, but making it like a field guide where you can quickly look something up, and there's a paragraph, and it says, you know, if you see this, then you can interpret it this way." And so he liked the idea. He took it to HarperCollins, and HarperCollins said, "You know, this would be a great follow-on to go from 140 behaviors to over 400. And so that was, there is your opus, Pete.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's cool. Well, Oh, so good. Well, I loved what everybody is saying. And I am looking forward to getting into all the more depths of the Dictionary of Body Language. So, well, thank you for writing it. It's just fun. Well, so I've got a ton of things I'd love to dig into. And so maybe I'd like to hear your take on. So when it comes to sort of gauging people's true intentions, and I know that's one of like the juiciest areas of the body language stuff. It's like, how do I know when someone's lying? That seems to be popular for your poker books, as well as, I don't know, maybe sort of untrusting partners or any number of contexts. So why don't we go with that first? How do you get to the bottom of people's true intentions and whether they're being honest with you?
Well, I knew you were going to hit me with this because you always ask profound questions.
Oh,
let's divide it up, because when we're talking about intentions, for instance, you're talking to somebody and their right foot begins to orient towards an exit.
Mm-hmm.
Usually we begin to communicate, I have to leave, with our feet. Before they even look at their watch, before they say anything, we show intentions by foot orientation. We show intentions such as, I really like that cake, by literally leaning towards it. And you know, you see that in courtship behaviors. I've certainly sat at enough cafes and bars studying individuals, and you can tell that when they're interested in each other. But the more profound question is, well, what about detecting deception? And I have to say, both as someone who has been intimately involved in the in all aspects of forensic interviewing, and in doing research for the books and for teaching, that as Dr. Mark Frank at University of Chicago says, there is no Pinocchio effect. There is really no single behavior indicative of deception, and we need to get away from that because we do a disservice to ourselves and to others. I think it's been too easy to say, well, I think you're lying. Well, why do you think that? Oh, because I asked you a question and you were touching your mouth. Well, the fact of the matter is, both the honest and the dishonest do it. And we do it because maybe we don't like the question. We think the question is too intrusive. Maybe we think that you are not entitled to ask that question because of social status or whatever. There's what I found interesting in doing an article for Psychology Today is I looked at the 261 DNA exonerations. And as I delved deep and I contacted the people that had done the research, looked at the casework of the police officers, every one of them thought that the suspects were guilty and lying when they said they didn't do it. What's interesting is not one police officer could identify who was telling the truth, but they all thought they could identify somebody that was lying. And what does that tell us tells us is that as Paul Ekman found in 1986, humans are terrible at detecting deception. We really shouldn't be in the business of detecting deception. Now, so what is it that we're looking for? Well, what's interesting is that humans are actually very good at detecting when something is wrong, when there's an issue. The question is, we don't know why. Babies are born communicating comfort and discomfort. We humans immediately reveal discomfort through our bodies, whether it's a heightened a heart rate, a pulsing vein, pacifying behaviors. But what we don't know is the why. And if I can tell you an FBI story, I worked mostly counterintelligence, and we were short of personnel one time, and I was asked to do an interview of a white-collar criminal. This woman is called in, and usually we spend the first 20, 30 minutes getting people to calm down, because obviously when you get called in by the FBI, it's pretty nerve-wracking. But as I'm talking to this lady, she seems to be demonstrating more and more behaviors of nervousness and tension. You know, she's biting her lip, she's grabbing her collar, she's squeezing her hands together. And finally, I said, ma'am, You know, I'm thinking to myself, Joe, you're the Bureau's expert on botany language. Surely you know what's going on here. So I thought I'd cut to the chase, and this is a lesson in humility. And I said, ma'am, you look like you need to get something off your chest. And she says, oh, thank God, Mr. Navarro, because when I parked downstairs, I only had a quarter in the meter. And so here were all the behaviors of nervousness and tension and anxiety. But what was the cause? The cause was she didn't want to get a ticket, didn't want to have to pay a fine. And as it turns out, somebody had stolen her identity and filed some bogus claims, insurance claims, and that's why she was being called in. And it was it really taught me a lesson about humility and saying, you know what, all we can really say is that I'm seeing behaviors. They're indicative of psychological discomfort. The question is, what's driving that?
Yeah. And then what's interesting is like some people can just be anxious, you know, in general, I imagine. Like that is sort of who they are all the time. And they're just not that comfortable in their own skin or talking to other people or talking to strangers or talking to official people like judges and FBI agents. Like,
oh, sure. Yeah. Look. And not even nervousness. There's people that don't like to make eye contact, that really feel uncomfortable being questioned and so forth. And so the investigator has to look at that and say, all right, who am I dealing with? What are the baseline behaviors? And then if they do notice behaviors, I mean, if you ask somebody, where were you last night? And if a question like that causes them to look like they're doing trigonometry, the question then becomes, why does a simple question cause so much mental turpitude? Mm-hmm. Why is there so much cognitive loading going on? But then that's for the investigator to figure it out. You know, as an agent, I can tell you that no matter what people said, we always had to prove what they said. And so it was a matter of, you know, if I ask a question, how did they react to that question? And no matter what their reaction was, I needed to pursue it anyway. So
right. Although what's cool though is with that those 32 names, because you got an indicator, you're able to, you know, really accelerate that hypothesis. Like, we have a good reason to suspect these are the two to go after, rather than
right
going through all 32.
Well, it's because I understood that when an object or a name or something is a threat to you, that you react to it. Now, what was important was not to give any indication of, you know, that any one of these individuals was any more special than the others. Mm-hmm. It was just a matter of, what can you tell me about their personalities, and then watching for the reactions. And then we lucked out with that. Now, you know, if the two men hadn't confessed, you know, certainly we couldn't go to court and say, well, judge, you know, we think they're guilty because this guy blinked. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
In the same way that when a child comes home and or a spouse comes home and they're having some sort of difficulty, maybe it doesn't help to ask any more questions at that moment. Maybe it helps to delay it to another time, so when they're relaxed, you get a better read to find out, oh, is somebody bullying you at work or at school or somewhere else?
That's good. Okay, so that being established in terms of, you know, it's hard to know whether someone's lying or deception, but rather you just kind of get a sense for, you know, what's causing discomfort. I'd love to hear, out of the 400-ish behaviors, you know, what are some of those that are kind of like the most reliable? Like, you know, Pete, over 90% of the time when I see this behavior, it tends to mean that thing. And I remember from what everybody is saying, you had some things to say about feet and how it's absurd that in interrogation rooms, there are opaque desks and they need to be transparent so that we could observe the feet. I was like, this is a guy who speaks from experience, because I've never seen anyone or heard anyone go on a rant quite like that. So I dug that. So So tell me, is it the feet, or what are some of the most reliable telltale things to look toward?
Well, actually, one of them you just did. And
it's,
you did what's called eyelid flutter.
Oh boy, what's it mean?
Eyelid flutter we do when we are emphasizing something, when we feel negative about something, when we're flustered by something. And you were channeling me there quite accurately.
Oh, thank you.
You know, when I wrote about interviewing and how you're a paid observer, and here you're sitting in for an interview, and the person's hiding behind a desk, and you cannot even see their feet or their hands or their torso. And it's like, I cannot believe that you as a professional not see the object of the interview, and they're hiding behaviors that are critical. Well, as you were channeling that, you did the eyelid flutter. Eyelid flutter is very accurate when we're struggling with something. But you mentioned the feet, and I think this is one of the things that was astonishing. And there's a really good section in the new book, The Dictionary of Body Language, dealing with the feet. Because I got so many questions over the years after I wrote that of people saying, well, is there anything more about the feet? And and I said that the feet are very accurate because they reveal our emotions, and we tend not to hide them in the same way that we might do a social smile.
Mm-hmm.
The feet, if they don't like you, if you don't like someone, your feet will move you away from that person. You will immediately rotate away. If you're excited and happy to see someone, you can hide a smile, but try to hide the feet of a child. I was just at the airport the other day, and a little kid arrived with a family. They're going to Disney, and every time the mother mentioned Disney World, the child's feet were jumping up and down. She had happy feet. Well, you can't hide that. And even with adults, poker players soon found out that you can see the happy feet of a player that has a monster hand just by the shirt shaking. So so the feet certainly has a lot of information. But you know, you were talking about, well, what are some of the more accurate, significant ones? There's another one that you do, which is great, and it's the gravity-defying behaviors of the eyebrows.
Hmm.
And when you
did that before you at the first. Well, we don't have the video for the listeners, and it's fun that you started with the video, and it should have occurred to me, of course, he wants the video.
Because it's very instructive.
Yeah.
And you can see how excited you are about things because you arch your eyebrows and you go, well, what about this and what about that? And think about the times when you greet somebody and they flash their eyebrows and they go, hey, how are you? And compare that to other times when you greet someone but you don't have those behaviors, and you realize, oh, that just doesn't feel the same. There's something going on here. And I often get this with I've taught many clinicians over the years, and they say, you know, a lot of times these couples come in and they say, well, I had no clue that she didn't love me anymore or he didn't love me anymore. And I say, stop right there. There were plenty of clues. You just didn't see them. You just didn't see them. You didn't see the eyes that never flash when they see you. You never saw that 2 years ago, you know, she was touching you with her fingertips rather than with her full palm hand. You didn't notice that rather than smiling at you, it was more of a little smirk, and the corner of her mouth was pinched, which shows disdain and so forth. And I said, there's always behaviors there.
That's so sad.
Well, it is, but the argument that I never saw it coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, and one of the important things that I really believe, Pete, is that if we're sensitive to other people's body language, we make better friends and better mates because we early on can begin to sense, oh, there's an issue. something is wrong. I mean, to wait for something 6 months, 2 years on is sometimes too late. I think if you begin to sense that, my partner, you know, she's bored watching TV another night. And when I mention going out, you know, her eyes light up. Well, you know, that's a clue. And so in the same way that as parents, we look at the baby for every single little sign of a smile, of any kind of discomfort, because we transmit information fairly much in a binary fashion, comfort, discomfort. The same thing applies in real life. And so, that's part of having that social intelligence, but it's also about equity, what we bring to the table as a partner and as a parent to ensure that that those we love are cared for.
That's powerful, yes. And it's funny, I'm thinking about my buddy Muhammad, who's going to be on the show a little later. It's exciting. And that is one I always feel very, welcomed or liked, appreciated when he greets me, because his eyebrows really do that. And I guess I have not articulated or thought of that specifically until we really got precise about that fact just now. So that's intriguing. And then, okay. So we got some feet. We got the eyelid flutter. We got the arching and lifting of eyebrows for excitement. What are some other big ones?
Yeah, so let me give you one that is just a remarkable behavior. And it really stands out with women, in part because oftentimes, their necks are more exposed than men, because we tend to wear shirts that have high collars, or we wear a tie and a coat or and so forth. And women have more of an open neck. And the behavior is covering of the lower neck area. There's a little dimple there called the suprasternal notch. And the suprasternal notch is just above the sternum. And that's why it's called the suprasternal.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And invariably, when someone is struggling with something, having difficulties, is insecure, there's a little bit of fear, they will immediately bring their hand up and cover this very sensitive area of the neck. Now, men, we tend to mask it by grabbing our necks more robustly and grabbing our shirts. Women tend to just put their finger on it. And in fact, just the other day, I think the day we talked or we emailed each other, there was an attack on the on a speech that was being given in Venezuela on the president of Venezuela, and it was a drone attack of some sort. And while all the soldiers stood there at attention, being mindful of their duty, the first lady, as soon as she sensed that something was wrong, her hand immediately went to the suprasternal notch to cover it. This is a very ancient behavior. This has to have been with us for tens and tens of thousands of years, maybe even longer, because it's seen in every society. It's been seen in every culture. And interestingly enough, it's been seen even with children who are born blind, who have never seen the behavior, and yet they perform this behavior when they feel threatened or scared. I would say it's one of those behaviors that is probably in the 95 to 96 percentile of saying, communicating that something is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. Well, any other sort of top probability items come to mind?
Yeah, one of the ones that I talk about in the new book is has to do with what is in essence a reserve behavior. And reserve behaviors are those behaviors that we really hold back until something is really stressing us, and then they come out. So we don't tend to do them every day. But every once in a while, when something is really bad, and one of those reserved behaviors is with the fingers. Now, in the previous book, I talked about steepling, and that's where you put your fingertips together and you straighten them up, and it looks like a church steeple.
It makes this me think of an evil genius.
Like Mr. Burns.
Excellent, Joe.
But this behavior is very similar, except that the fingers are rigid, straight, and they interlace, and the person sort of rubs them back and forth with very straight fingers. And I started to see this behavior probably in the 80s with people in who were going to be interviewed, people who were in trouble. But I also verified it by looking at these very old videos. They weren't even videos. They were 35mm movies from the 1950s of couples in therapy. And one of the things that I found was that when they were about ready to say, look, you know, this relationship is over, they would often do this behavior. And I call it TP hands. Because when they interlace and the fingers are straight, if you were to hold it right in front of you, it looks like the top of a teepee with the poles sticking out. And I tell parents, look, if you're talking to a child and they start to do this behavior, because they do it subconsciously, you know, put your iPhone away and pay attention, because something is significant here. This is a reserve behavior. We have another reserve behavior, which is kind of interesting, and I hadn't written about it before, but it's in the new dictionary of body language, and that's called facial denting. And facial denting is you often see this at sporting events where the score is really close, and you'll see people squeeze their cheeks to the point where, as you look at them, you say, surely that's got to hurt. Pop a tooth. And they're squeezing themselves so tight. And that's one of those reserved behaviors for when we're dealing with a lot of stress and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. Now, why we do that, it hasn't really been very well studied. And I'm hoping, one of the things that I'm hoping, you know, you were asking me earlier, what are some of my hopes for this book? My hope is that researchers will look at it and say, okay, so here are things that this FBI guy over 40 years picked up by watching people. Let's go and test it. Let's go and verify it. Let's go validate it. I hope they tear into it and they try to demonstrate that it's universal or not universal, that it's peculiar to this area of the world or that world, or that it's used when we're stressed or unstressed or whatever. But I'm hoping that the average person can use it to learn, but I'm also hoping that the researchers will look at things that they've never looked at before.
Yeah, well, that's really cool. And just to note that if you're seeing the TPing or the facial denting, that we're dealing with something serious here. And yeah. It's funny. I could think of a buddy who everything was going wrong on his wedding day. In terms of like things coming together and you know, oops, so-and-so didn't pick up his tux and this person's late and he's getting all these texts. So it was a lot of stuff. And he was sure doing some good squeezing there. And that all makes sense that it was intensely troublesome for him, but it all worked out. They got married. They're happy and it's good. Yeah. So that's cool. Well, I'd love to hear maybe precisely or more specifically when it comes to in the world of professionals in their day-to-day job, career lives, what do you think are some of the most helpful things to be on the lookout for in terms of what you're observing or what you're projecting? And I'm thinking about things like maybe someone is bored or thinks that idea is wrong and just a terrible, because I think that happens a lot in meetings. Like someone says something and someone thinks that is a terribly bad idea, but they don't say anything because they want to stick their neck out. That's the big boss. They don't want to, offend or insult. Are there any indicators along those lines or other helpful kind of career scenarios?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it's really a good question. And I would have to say, number one, if you're taking notes, write this one down. We are always transmitting information. And a lot of people think, oh, I'm in the parking lot, nobody's going to notice me, or I'm in the elevator, nobody's going to notice me, or I'm sitting outside for an interview, nobody's noticing me, or I'm at the end of the table, no one's going to notice me. Stop right there. Welcome back to planet Earth.
No.
The fact of the matter is that you are being observed constantly, and people are picking up on everything. Let's go through a few of the things that you probably never thought about. Good manners. Manners are nonverbals, right?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, if you see a piece of paper on the floor and you pick it up and you put it in the garbage can, that is a behavior that you don't have to talk to do that one. How you talk to people, your intonation, how quickly you respond. Do you face them or do you roll your eyes before you answer them and so forth? So good manners is a nonverbal. And the fact of the matter is that we're all being scrutinized. People look at us and they notice how well-groomed we are. Walk into an office and change your haircut. And people, you got a different haircut. And you probably have gone through your life thinking, nobody notices me. No, everybody notices. They notice if you're wearing glasses. They're noticing if you wear new glasses, if you change your hairdo, your color. If you're not well groomed, if all of a sudden you've gone from really nice clothing to really tattered mm-hmm. clothing, they notice.
They're noticing the wrinkles in my polo shirts, Joe. Do I have to start ironing these things?
Yeah. And so it makes you think. You know, Shakespeare was right. Life is theater, and we're on stage. And for a lot of jobs, how we look may not matter. But the fact of the matter is that for a lot of jobs, it does matter. It matters how we, as clinicians say, how we present. Are we on time? Are we eager? Are we leaning forward? Are we interested? Something so simple. You know, we were talking earlier about great behaviors. Here's one behavior that you need to build into your repertoire, and that's when people are talking to you that you tilt your head slightly, because we know that from a very young age, babies respond to this, and it's a behavior that says, I'm listening to you, I'm interested, I don't have an agenda for the moment, and I'm actively listening. And it's a very easy behavior to emulate, and especially with children and loved ones. You know, I live in a community not far from Central Command, where there's a lot of Navy SEALs. And, you know, these guys have great bodies. I mean, they're like world-class athletes. But I notice how they talk even to their spouses, and they look like drill sergeants. And it's like they can't stand down. And I think one of the things that enhances communication, especially with loved ones, is if we can stand down and relax and tilt that head and just say, I'm listening, and tell me about your day, and not look like we're looking for the next marching orders. And I have to say, a lot of executives come home and do the same thing. They have that very stern, I'm in charge sort of look. And we know that humans respond to that look of interest and kindness.
Yeah, so interest, kindness, kind of letting go and not be in charge, tilting the head. Any other kind of indicators of I'm listening, I'm interested, I'm not bored, I'm not formulating a response, I'm not getting my argument ready?
Yeah, I'm on the road all the time, and I'm giving presentations all over the world. And so you're running, you know, one day you're in Germany, the next day you're in Romania, and then you're back in Chicago, and then you're on the West Coast, and you're talking to people in Beijing. You're talking to people from all over the world. And what's interesting is what seafarers found 400, 500 years ago, that affability, having a smile. One of the things that works really well, and I encourage young business people to do this, is don't feel like you have to stand directly in front of another person. That in fact, we tend to increase the amount of time we are with others if we will just slightly angle to them so that we're not directly in front of them. We're just at a slight angle to them. And by angling, we increase what's called face time. And obviously for business, this is really critical, is increasing face time. And so I have found this works in every culture, wherever I've been. Instead of just standing right in front of them, you greet them, you angle to the side, and there's a sense of harmony. And we have to remember that when the conquistadores arrived in the New World, they saw the same behaviors here that they had seen in Queen Isabella's court. Mm-hmm. The king had better clothing, he sat higher, he had an entourage, he couldn't be touched, blah, 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 everything that in Queen Isabella's court. So these are universal things that are endearing, such as, you know, giving people the requisite amount of space. In fact, I just wrote an article about that for Psychology Today, because I go around asking folks, how far away do you like people to stand near you? And it's kind of shocking to listen to what they say, and it's always greater than where people are standing next to them. they say 3 to 4 feet, and some people want even more. So be sensitive to the spatial needs of other people. That some people just don't like others to be too close, you know. And be yourself. Be natural. Not everybody's going to be an alpha. There will always be omegas. There's a place for everybody. But also, you know, be mindful that if you have something important, that you should be heard. And one of the things I notice a lot with, especially with young women coming into business, is that often they sit rather demure at their seat. And then almost the meeting is over and they don't have an opportunity to talk. And oftentimes they're not giving away the cues that say, I have something important to say. And those things are, instead of leaning back, leaning forward and in, when you have something ready to say, making direct eye contact with the person that is either presently speaking or is the moderator, to let them know, hey, I have something to say. And the other one is not steepling. You know, steepling, and that's where the fingertips are together, is really the only universal sign that we have of confidence, that we're confident about what we're thinking or about to say. And
we should not steeple.
No, we should. When we have something important to say, you don't want to do it all the time. And what I found in my studies was that oftentimes women will do it low on their lap or at, you know, not very high, when in fact they should do it so it's visible, so that it communicates to everybody, this is important and I'm very confident that at this moment. Look at Angela Merkel, over in the UK, or in Germany, sorry. And she steeples all the time. But you know, she has a doctorate in engineering and she is very confident. And so you see those behaviors. And I, you know, I used to see them also with Margaret Thatcher and others. So it's a behavior you want to emulate. You want to use it at the right time in the right place, but you also need to communicate, I want to be heard. And so those are some, I think, good indicators there.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Well, now tell me, Joe, anything else you really want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some of your favorite things?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the important things about body language is that I continue to be a student of it. You know, I'd like to one day be able to say, yeah, I have the definitive expertise. And I'm reluctant to do that because I'm learning things all the time. I'm observing things all the time. I think it behooves us to learn this language that is so part of us as humans. And it's the primary way that we demonstrate love and empathy, and that's pretty important. It's also the way that we sense and detect danger, right? We're at an ATM machine. We're looking over our shoulder. It's late at night. We're looking for somebody sneaking up on us. And it's the number one way that we choose our mates. We don't ask for a resume. We look at them, we smell them, we touch them, we watch them, and we make decisions based on nonverbal. So a lot of people think, well, it's, you know, is it really that important? Well, I can't think of anything more important than safety, child rearing, and mate selection. That pretty much hits it out of the park.
Oh, well said. Thank you. Well, now, could you share with us a favorite quote, something that you find inspiring?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite quotes, and I know a lot of people will hear this who have been to my seminars, and it's, I'm going to paraphrase, but it comes to us from Carl Sagan. And Carl Sagan, the cosmologist, absolutely brilliant, taken from us at too early of an age. But he said, you know, we're really not who we think we are. But if you were to ask, what are we? Is we're the sum total of our influence on others. And I think it's very true. You yourself, with your podcast, sharing knowledge, sharing ideas, that's influential. And I look at the people that have influenced me in life, and I think, what was it that was great about it? Could they build something? Could they do this? We love people that are skilled with a craft, but we're mostly influenced by those that are influential, and they do that by how they live their lives.
Excellent. Thank you. And how about a favorite study or experiment or a bit of research?
One of my favorite ones came out a few months ago, and it just goes to show how sensitive we humans are to the smallest of little details. So they grabbed somebody and they put a green sweater on them, and they said, go out and ask for favors. And they did. And then they took the same person, and they, on the sweater, they put the logo of a high-end clothing manufacturer. And it was only a half an inch logo. And they sent him out to go and ask people for favors. Like, can I use your phone? Can I park here? Can I come inside? And all this stuff. So the times when he wore the logo, 52-53% of the people agreed to help out. When he didn't wear the logo, only 13%.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So what does that tell social scientists? And I've done this experiment, interestingly enough, with people just wearing beach shoes, flip-flops, ones that cost $1.99, and then ones that were from a famous manufacturer.
So they're still flip-flops. Both,
they're still,
but just different. Still, yeah.
But different manufacturer. Yeah. And invariably, in my non-scientific study, those that wore the nicer got better treatment. What does that tell us? That anthropologists and biologists would say, look, we're primates, and we're very sensitive to hierarchy, and we will always be sensitive to hierarchy and the markers of, well, who is the alpha, who's the silverback, and who is everybody else? And we cannot escape that.
You all. That's powerful. Thank you. And how about a favorite book?
My favorite writer is Steinbeck, so Grapes of Wrath. But the one book that I return to over and over and over again is The Histories by Herodotus. Mm. It's the only book that I've actually read 6 times. Here's the father of history writing 2,500 years ago, and he's telling us about the world as it existed then. It's just exquisite in its breadth.
Mm-hmm. And how about a favorite habit?
Favorite habit, it has to be going out for a walk with my family at night. I love them dearly. My wife, my dog, and I enjoy their company.
And is there a particular nugget you share that really seems to connect and resonate that folks, you know, retweet it, they quote it back to you often?
Yeah, there's one in particular. I'm glad you asked that. And I put it out there many, many years ago when I first started on Twitter, and I didn't know it would become that significant. And it's someone told me that it may have been not necessarily borrowed, but it's a variant of what somebody else had said, and it probably is, since there's nothing new under the sun. But basically, what it says is that what we do in private, when nobody is watching us, is important, more important than we're in public, and that when we help those who can do nothing for us, that is the true measure of our humanity, because there is no expectation of any kind of reward. And for some reason, that seemed to resonate with a lot of people.
And Joe, if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
Very easily, my website, jnforensics.com. My books are all the major retailers. Certainly, they're available on Amazon, or they can come to your website.
Mm-hmm. Sure thing.
Look there.
And do you have a final challenge or call to action that you issue to folks who are seeking to be awesome at their jobs?
I do. Become better observers, and you'll become better humans. You cannot attend to others if you can't observe them. And I think most of us know how to look, but very few of us know how to observe.
Awesome. Well, Joe, this has been such a treat. Thank you for taking this time, and good luck with the Dictionary of Body Language and all that you're up to here.
Well, thank you, Pete. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
I really love what Joe had to say about your body language conveying manners, and how if you tilt the head and if you let your eyebrows lift, it shows your interest. And it was cool that he called out that I am showing great interest in what he had to say. And it's true, I was. It's proof. The FBI interrogator said that he saw interest on my face when I was interviewing him. So I'm glad that comes through, you know, from the body language that you don't normally get to see. And hopefully also with the voice that I'm digging this stuff. And I hope you're digging it too and finding it enriching. And so with that manners perspective, how you can become all the more likable and polite and kind and generous just by making an effort to do those little things of the leaning and the eyebrow lifting. And what struck me is I realized often I don't do that, especially like in a meeting environment. If it's one-on-one, usually I do. But if it's sort of like a broad meeting, a speaker is sharing their perspective, you know, their take, their presentation. And I'm just thinking really hard about all of the implications and possibilities and potential optimal solutions and hacks and quick tricks and tactics that might make whatever we're working on go better to just get it all optimized. And so that's sort of where my brain is going. And in the process of thinking really hard, my face really isn't kind and friendly and supportive in those sort of polite ways that Joe mentioned. So that was helpful for me, especially if a speaker is nervous or you know, have not yet built a good, strong relationship from rapport. I'd probably really appreciate it to convey that with my face to the person speaking in a meeting and maybe do my intense scheming thoughts a little bit later. So what's more, if you want to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items we've referenced, it's over to awesomeatyourjob.com/ep341. And if you haven't already, I hope you'll push the subscribe button. You'll hear from our next guest. It's Tom Hefner. Tom has a genius job working for a government applied physics laboratory, and he's applying design thinking and doing some real cool creative innovation stuff in real life. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. To get the most out of this conversation, visit awesomeatyourjob.com to find today's show notes, transcript, and infographic summary cheat sheet. For more entertaining professional skill sharpening, be sure to subscribe to catch the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.